This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia, on the Community Radio Network, via satellite to over 70 community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Your hosts today are Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Hello and welcome to Word for Word. My name's Dean Beck and my co-host today is Sue Wilkinson, and our guest in this hour has been a multimedia producer, a research artist with some 30 years experience in broadcasting, producing. She's been an actress, a writer. She's an artist both in painting and mixed media, right through to text and radio presentation. She prides herself on being a out loud queer freak.
Yeah.
And at nearly 50, she celebrates all sorts of differences, from raw physical bodies through to open alternative political and gender states of being. Kath Duncan, welcome to Word for Word.
Ah, thank you, Dean. Hello. And
Sue.
Hello, Sue.
Hello, Kath. It's so lovely to meet you. You know, when we start doing these shows, we look at researching, and it's just so interesting reading about you and your life. And you know what I found? What I found was, and if people do want to look up further, because I'm sure their interest is going to be tweaked, and there's just not enough out there on in the visual, like on the YouTubes and on and all that, to actually go, there's the person who's talking. You can get, you know, the blurb of this and the blurb of that, but I'd really love to see some more visuals of you and your productions.
Oh, that would be a good idea, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because you look up Kath Duncan and it goes, did you mean? And I go, no, I didn't mean that.
But I think that's, now we should rewind, actually.
Okay.
We should
rewind. I always go ahead. I get excited.
Because our listener has got no idea what we're talking about.
Oh.
Kath produced what turned out to be, and she also starred in, an internationally renowned documentary called My One-Legged Dream Lover.
Infamous it is, really.
Infamous in all sorts of ways. But we need to rewind back even further from that.
Oh, my God.
Kath, what is your disability?
Oh, Dean,
I know.
Forward. I'm going to ask you about your penis size.
Oh, don't, because he will tell you. And I've seen pictures.
Everyone knows. Okay, it's not interesting. Okay, but whatever. Okay,
it's really
so
not
my
worth worrying
disability
about
is probably more interesting at this point. Okay. Okay. Well. Okay. Can I do the shark and the crocodile? I was going along through.
Yes.
Oh, well, anyway, look, the reality is.
No, it's not going to work.
It's a bit late. I should have come up with it first. I was born with this sort of syndrome, which is like a classic developmental delay, actually, and it's called facial limb disruptive spectrum. And what happens is, if you're a woman who's carrying a baby, and between 6 and 10 weeks gestation, the baby, and you have either a viral or a bacterial infection that raises your blood temperature by more than only 0.25 of a degree.
Just in this little window.
Just that window.
Right. Yep.
It's likely that two things will happen. You'll have a miscarriage and you'll never really know.
Yep.
Or your fetus's embryos, ultimately baby's development gets affected. So in my case, even when we're that small, at the point of development I was at, we're really smart because we decide, even this little tiny blobby thing, to keep the brain, nervous system and organs, you know, heart and so forth, developing while going, hell, these unimportant things are just going to fall off the table. So what fell off the table at that point when my life as a little tiny being was threatened was my left I've just got an elbow on the left arm.
Just almost above the elbow, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's just sort of, or I've kind of lost the lower part of the lower part of your army thing.
Forearm and hand.
And to kind of carry on that trimming sort of around that side of the body, so on my left leg I only have four toes and a slightly shortened lower leg thing, bone.
I love your descriptions.
And then following around, we're now over on the right side.
Oh, now we're on the right leg. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right leg. I got about two thirds of where my leg was going to make a knee and then it stopped. So I've got this. Look, what's really good for prostheses is that I have what would have been a knee or a foot. We're not really sure, but I have this bony platform at the bottom of my leg stump, which is, yeah, about two thirds of the same length of above the knee on my left leg. Sorry. Oh, this is so complicated.
Left, right, straight, no.
Whatever. Anyway, look, I wear a leg prosthesis on the right side. I don't wear an arm prosthesis on the left side. I've got a full right arm, but I've got sort of a foreshortened finger. I call my fairy finger. And a smaller jaw and no earlobes. Everything just got trimmed.
Because I, looking at you, I would have thought,
he's such a bitch.
Yes, I would have said you were short, but I would have said that your torso is all very normal.
He's so not politically correct, is he?
He's awful, isn't he?
No, I know.
Thanks for that, Dean. That's good. I aspire to more than normal.
Let me apologize.
I've got great
up front.
Tits. Okay.
You have got.
She has actually. I will
knockers.
Vouch for that.
Okay. No, massive they're not
knockers.
Massive. They're
they
just
massive.
A good
I
shape.
I have to tell you, they're massive.
They're massive.
Oh, okay. Anyway, they're a good shape.
But
an old hag leg.
But you've got a bit of a leg on one side and not much on the other, and you've got half an arm and one good arm.
There you go. That'll do.
That'll do.
Now,
I'll have you know.
On.
This good thing. Mm. Let's just drop that straight off. Now, this right arm here, yeah, it's good for some things, but this left arm, I'm not going to go into it right now.
Yeah.
This is very good for some things.
Yeah.
Just leave it at that.
We are going, actually.
There's no good, bad here.
We're not going to leave
it's
that.
It's all good.
Because we are so getting into that very, very soon. But I do want to touch on politically correct.
That took forever, didn't it?
No. I want to touch on politically correct, because do you find literally people put their foot in their mouths, or they go, I don't know how to say, do I say amputee, do I say disability, do I say disability? Oh. That's a new one. I like disability because I work with kids with disabilities. And people go, well, it's not a disability, it's a diffability. And you go, it sounds like you've got a speech impediment.
Another one, yeah.
Yeah, and then do you say intellectually impaired and the word retarded, and you get this whole kind of gambit of words you should and shouldn't use. Do you find that with you personally? Do you find that people struggle with what to say?
Yeah, and I don't make it any easier. I mean, you know, sometimes just depending on my mood, someone will come up and go, you know, what's wrong with you? And I'll go, you know, and make up some ridiculous story, and I've frightened children at parties and stuff like that. I mean, I think it's up to the person to ID, to self-ID, because, like, just the other day I was talking to a good friend of mine who's in Adelaide, and I was saying, let's see if I can get this right, I'm a unipedal technological bipedal person, which means without the leg technology, I actually have one leg, but with the technology, I have two.
Mm.
So I can't say I'm a one-legged person. I'm a technological two-legged in a kind of a way.
It
gets very complicated. I mean, I think it's probably best if you want to be really PC, you ask the person, how do you describe yourself, you know, and work from there. But, you know, who's got the time? And quite a lot of the time people will sort of sum me up, you know, wrongly, really. I mean, the thing that offends me is when people think I've got some other weird disability.
Yeah.
The trouble I had in calling you disabled was that you're so bloody out there that nothing holds you back.
Yeah, but that's tragic, because what that's saying is that the other disabled people just aren't out there enough. Because there's lots of us.
Absolutely.
I know us all.
Absolutely.
I know us all.
No,
absolutely.
I don't actually.
I've got the phone book.
Yeah. But I think that's the thing. If I can say, it was tricky getting into this building, guys, with my beautiful mobility scooter, which has totally changed my life, and I'm not prepared to leave outside there in Bourke Street. And anyway, just on that note, to get around, then you see less of, like, colourful creatures like me.
Absolutely.
The basics, you're absolutely right, because we have steps coming into the building. And it was a struggle. You called the studio and said, hang on a minute, what's going on? Because you have to make alternate plans, you know, we have to get
someone. Oh, it never even occurred to me, guys. You should see who else is in this building. It's actually, you know, smorgasbord of community organisations. So.
And not one bloody wheelchair ramp.
And that's why they've kicked the cafe out downstairs, so that will be the wheelchair access.
Oh, we'll all be here cracking the champagne over that ramp, I can tell you.
Kath, I want to go back into, because we've started about, you know, where you are and you as you're an embryo, so I'd like to move a little bit forward from from the embryonic state and talk about your family life and growing up.
Oh, now you, lovely.
I know. I think from what I've read, you had a really rich family and a really good relationship.
Rich?
Well, not rich as in money. Rich as in love.
Oh, yeah, right? Very loving.
Let's talk about your family and how you fit in there.
It's colourful. I'm the middle child of five, two different marriages. I grew up in the
You've got the middle child syndrome. Now, that's got to be
middle child is the best.
It is.
Don't believe anyone who says that there's a problem with it because there's so much going on either side of you.
You hide in the middle.
That you get away with murder in the middle. That's all I'm saying. But I grew up in the southwestern suburbs of Sydney, in Benaresville or whatever it was called. And but I was lucky to grow up in a very bushy, sort of suburb. It's all gone now, unfortunately, but, sort of this tumbling gum and bracken rock filled thing that sloped down to a creek. So I always grew up with lots of space around me and I wanted to be in the city and, went to, special school.
I was just going
to
say, cause I was
7.
50 years ago, the education guide was, oh, you poor little thing.
Yeah, you got sort of streamed separately from the other kids quite young. In fact, it happened to me when I was just over a year old. Probably one of those random things they do, you know, just to get your technology right as a kid with, you know, disabilities and stuff. But anyway, so I went to special school for 7 years and then left there, then went to mainstream school also in that suburb and, you know, eventually ended up doing really well at high school, at a selective school in Sydney. I'm assuming you have them down here as well.
Is that for the gifted children?
Smarter kids, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
My mother went to one of those.
One day I'll hope I'll go. So you've gone, isn't that amazing to show that just because of a physical or born with a physicality, that they went, okay, you're special school orientated.
Yeah, it's interesting though. I ended up doing a PhD on this topic of, you know, special school and what happened to the kids who went there. And interestingly, of the, you know, 14 or so I tracked down who were at special school at the time I was there, you know, the bulk of us are professionals. We've sort of been that superhuman, you know, you've got to prove yourself twice as much and blah, blah. With all of us, well, the ones I could track down have done really well in our fields and sort of stood out in our fields and, you know, had mixed feelings about having had that streaming process happen to them as young people. But it certainly, well, it either crushes you or it means that from a very early age, 2, 3, you start to have to speak up for yourself because you work out very quickly that if you don't, you will end up shunted away in a corner somewhere with someone spoon feeding you.
And I can imagine that
mopping you up. Yeah. Well, obviously,
so
I think it did.
People.
Yep.
It's happened to so many people that it's like, I guess I'm trying to assimilate to a psychiatric ward. You're in a psychiatric ward trying to prove you're sane.
What do you, what do you put down to that extra, I guess, 10% that pushed you through? Is it just you or is it your family upbringing and your mum and dad supporting you and that sort of stuff?
Mum was great. Dad was a bit of a dead loss. Poor old dad. God bless him, whatever. I think my sisters, I have, you know, with the five kids, me in the middle, the two younger ones in particular, I grew up very closely with, and we had this love and bond between us. And as I've gotten older and worked out that it's not just people with disabilities who have a hard time, that in actual fact, you know, all sorts of things impact on people all of the time. And I worked out that because of, you know, mainly my mother and my grandparents really and my two younger sisters, I had this solid core belief that I was okay. Despite what anyone else might have said, I had this core belief that I was okay. I had a belonging place. I had a place where everything I said or did was funny and good and positive and uplifting or worth arguing and fighting about, but the love was there. And people who I've later found who may have not had the sort of physical challenges that I've had, but who didn't have that, I think struggle.
Absolutely. So you would have had this shelter. I don't want to use the word sheltered, but it was an environment where you were safe and secure and you felt
generally,
all those kind of things.
Yeah.
But then in the world outside that home, There must have been discrimination and ostracism. I'd like to talk about that side of it for you.
Well, interestingly, I've kind of theorised about this and I've come up with a new disorder that I call congenital difference affective disorder. And I've based it a bit on dissociative personality disorder and borrowed a bit from all over. I have no psych qualifications whatsoever. I just thought I'd make that really clear. But my theory goes like this, that because at a young age you learn there's the self that has to do these uncomfortable, embarrassing, intrusive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, test questions. With anyone, it appeared to me, and strip off, everything touched. You sort of develop the performative Kath as such, who you just leave to do all that stuff. While the real you, like dissociative personalities, and while the real you goes off and, you know, just wanders off in your head. And as I've gotten older and I've sort of seen the kind of, you know, cracks and fissures through the sort of, you know, the person I think of as myself, I've sort of thought, oh, wow, yeah, I can really relate to this dissociative thing because I've got this performative calf who will just stand up and do it. And the rest of me just goes, ugh, you know, and particularly for medical examinations and all those things, even now, I really have to gear myself up if I'm just going to go and have a checkup or a consultation. I really have to, right, Kath, I'm not going to die, you know, and all this. I hate them.
So have you throughout your whole life had to be prodded like aliens
being
transported away?
Oh, totally.
And you just had to take that on board?
Well, I remember at 16, okay, so I had to have lots of prosthetics fitted and measured and weighed.
As you were growing and
stuff. Because you go through them really quickly.
You grow out of them.
When you're growing up, I probably had about 40 legs.
Wow.
I don't know, whatever. I used to have arms. I got rid of them.
They're
whatever.
Like school shoes.
I love that. I had 40 legs.
And at 16, there was this really horrible doctor, an abusive doctor. I won't name this person, but anyone who grew up in Sydney will know who I'm talking about. And this person came in and grabbed me by the nose. And I remember my brother had started teaching me karate. And I remember just up and slamming him as hard as I could with my fist, because I was a bit of a fighter too, in his forearm.
No, do you think?
I can't see it. Yeah.
I remember that as this great moment where I finally said, no, stop.
Right.
Why would anybody do that? Grab you by the nose?
Because he was an interfering pedophilic asshole bastard.
Right. Oh, but that
and everyone knows it. And I punched him. And that felt tops.
Can I go into that then? Do you find that, I'm talking about the 16-year-old, and prior to the 16-year-old, you had to be more in your face, you had to stand up that bit more, or did you find that you had to be a little bit more subtle because people weren't going to take it from you?
Oh, well, I think actually what you learn, I think, is that you have to, the same tactics won't work with, I mean, you have to, what I think a lot of people who've grown up as I have, congenitally different, have had to work out is being able to suss the situation out really, really quickly. What should I do at this point to get out or get into this? And it's always been different. I couldn't say any one approach really worked and did this or whatever. It's very much of the situation. Like, I've been able to talk down crazy bastards and other times I've walked away.
But I would imagine that mouth of yours has got you into some trouble.
Yes, it has.
Oh, let's talk about that.
Oh, no, let's not. Actually, we may as well, because Dean touched on this earlier, why don't we talk a bit about amputee fetish and that whole thing?
We're moving into that.
Oh, okay.
Kath,
this isn't your interview.
Exactly, Kath. You're not producing this one, so back off.
Oh, dear.
We're speaking to Kath Duncan, who is engaged in a lifelong learning project to leave a legacy of resistant images, texts, sounds and presentations. And can I just say,
that's nice, huh?
We're honoured that we're one of them.
Excellent!
On the Community Radio Network, Word for Word with Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson.
Our guest today is Kath Duncan, who produced an internationally renowned doco called My One-Legged Dream Lover. Kath discovered that somewhere out in that world, there was a whole throng of men that were amputee.
And women too.
And women that were amputee devotees, attracted to people like Kath that were born different or had limbs removed. So she went about making a movie and a doco on it. And it challenged many people, including whoever it was that lodged the complaint with the broadcasting corporation to SBS. Kath, that experience.
Let's talk about the movie. I'm a bit excited.
Wow.
What a great...
Where did that come out of? And Tell us about the journey.
Oh, well, it was one of those bizarre sort of little stories in that I had just moved to Lismore and I just got a new job at the university there. And I didn't know many people in town, and so I logged on. I thought, you know, it'd be good to have a kind of a virtual support network, because in Sydney I'd known a lot of people who were also disabled and we were buddies and all, and I missed them, you know. So anyway, so I logged on looking, you know, searching for amputees and stuff. And I don't think I ever found any amputees, come to think of it. But what I did find was that there was this whole fetish thing. And I mean, I'd sort of heard about that in an obscure way when I was much younger, from reading Everything You Always Want to Know About Sex, which is a very interesting book that came out in the 60s or 70s or something. And I remember reading that and reading a bit about fetish and thinking, oh, how weird. But then I found this community. And at first I was a bit turned off and just sort of, you know, posted something on some site somewhere saying, I'm looking for people who have similar, you know, disabilities to mine to chat. I'm not looking for love. I'm not looking for romance. I just want friends. And my email inbox just filled up with devotees. And so I sort of had to engage with it. And I was a radio feature sort of freelance producer at the time. And I thought, you know, there's a radio feature in this. And so I made one with the talented team at the Women's Unit at ABC Radio National in Sydney. And I was in the process of finishing that off when the phone rang. And it was my friend Penny Fowler-Smith, and I went through university with Penny. And unfortunately, she'd just done a pitch for a documentary at SBS that had fallen over. And SBS had said to her, we really like your work though. Come back to us with an idea. And she goes, Kath, what do you got? And I said, oh God, well, I'm working on this crazy thing that, you know, it's about fetish, but you know, check this. What I would really love to do is the following year, May or such, there's going to be in Chicago, the biggest meeting of amputees, because there's this American Amputees Association, and the biggest meeting of the fetishists at the, in the town on the same weekend. In the same place. Wouldn't that be fun?
Not by sheer coincidence, I gather.
Wait, with careful planning, I've no
doubt.
Yes,
indeed.
And Penny went, oh my God. And so she introduced me to Chris Olsen, who was another producer friend of hers. And the three of us sat down and over, you know, biscuits or whatever, we drafted this proposal, and those guys were really good at turning that around budget-wise, much sharper than me. So I sort of supplied the research, and then they turned it into this, you know, lovely little prospectus thing, sent it off a little bit. And that would have been, I think, in about December or something of that year.
About 10 years ago, wasn't it?
And then in February, I get a message from Chris on my phone thing just going, start packing. And I go, whoa. And sure enough, by the end of April that year, we were off, and we had to turn it around. We had to go over there, attend various events, do a whole lot of filming, blah, 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 and have the thing edited up and delivered to SBS by the end of the year. So we had 8 months or so to make it. And it was it was pretty special. Of course, the interesting thing about making a documentary and working with a team is that on the flight over, I realized that all of us, including the camera guy, had very different ideas about what it was we were doing. And to a certain extent, that same sort of like difference of opinion and an argy-bargy about what the hell it was we were doing lasted that whole 8 months. And it was actually quite a complicated process. We turned up, we ended up with something that we'd all worked on, and not all of us none of us were 100% happy, and none of us were 100% unhappy. It was like that.
But it went on to win an award in Amsterdam.
Festival. Unfortunately, it's a bit like the, you know, three times a bridesmaid, never a bride, in that Dream Lover got nominated for the Melbourne Film Festival, Sydney Film Festival. This is all its nominations, darling, not the ones that it won. And over in our premiere, our world premiere was fabulous, because IDFA picked it up, which is the International Documentary Film Festival. Amsterdam picked it up, and they asked us to come over, blah, blah, blah. So we did. So the first time it ever screened publicly beyond a few test audiences of friends was in Amsterdam while it was snowing. You know, it's just amazing. And for some of your older listeners, Zavira Hollander was there, who wrote The Happy Hooker in the 50s or 60s, whenever. And she was there, and she stood up and declared herself a devotee. And the crowd went crazy, and the questions were great. It was tops. And then we found out.
Sounds like you were a celebrity.
It does.
Well, we weren't until we got selected, because year at IDFA, there's as I remember it, a major award for each filmic documentary and one for each TV documentary. Right. And there were three documentaries nominated for the TV award, and we were one of those. And it's like called the Silver Bear or something like that. Anyway, so the minute we got nominated, we were huge. Just people, you know, trying to interview us and la la la, take photos and blah, blah, blah. And we, our screenings filled up because you have a series of screenings. And the idea is you've got to attract people and sure. They just, you know, just filled up and blah, blah, blah. And, we didn't win. We came second, or we, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, we just didn't win. But interestingly, another Australian documentary, and the partner of our producer, Chris Olsen, won that year for that film about the Piano Chick family. Sorry. Oh, God, they're going to hate the Piano Chick family. Anyway, whatever. They did really well, and he was there, which is really cute. So the whole thing went off.
It would have helped with sales internationally, surely, to get that sort of profile.
Well, it didn't, no. Oh. Because HBO turned it down. As all of us realised, there were very significant flaws in that documentary, which I'm not probably going to talk about so much. But interestingly, when HBO looked at it, they turned it down for the same reasons that I thought were problematic about the piece.
Not that the subject matter was too challenging.
No.
Right.
No, it was more like the emotional kind of structuring of the piece.
I want to talk about I want to talk sex, basically.
Oh, okay.
Because in reading about you, you sort of, what am I going to say? You kind of woke up and went, oh, hello, I'm seen as a sex object in this. Is that right?
Yes.
It's coming from a different perspective.
No. Well, I had always had an interesting love life, personally. It was more that these very underplayed, insignificant, uncomfortable parts of my body were seen as sexualized. It wasn't so much that I was, because I was used to that to a certain extent.
But these are parts that people are directly attracted to.
Yeah,
is it you that is uncomfortable about them, or you that's made to feel uncomfortable about them?
I would have to say I thought at least some of my lovers were uncomfortable about my stumps.
Right, yeah, sure. But these ones were.
Maybe I was too.
Yeah.
I couldn't say who was more and who wasn't. But at this point, that's what I realized, that they sort of despised, that's the word I'm looking for, parts of my body could be
ultimate turn on.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was the journey for me to find out, wow, what's that like?
Was that empowering?
Well, you know what really changed? Sort of. I mean, personally, that was more problematic. But publicly, what I realized was, now for me, okay, long-haul plane flights, I hate wearing my leg. But for years and years and years, I'd be too uncomfortable to take my leg off. Well, I suddenly realized it was kind of just okay to be me publicly. So I'm now so much more comfortable about taking my leg off and on, crawling over this, changing this, doing this, exposing myself publicly than I ever was prior to doing the Dream Lover experience.
Uh-huh.
That really changed. And so, yes, if then the question of, you know, does it help to have these despised parts adored in that way? Yes. And for a while there on planes and, you know, at swimming pools and stuff, I would think there's a devotee watching, and so I'm going to make this really interesting.
And that was one little
psychological game, because I really did used to struggle with, like, taking my clothes off in public. I used to find that really uncomfortable. But after this, I got into it. So, yeah, so these days I no longer have that. So that's been really good. But on a personal level, I guess I realized that, you know, fetishes are just as, you know, banal, boring, screwed
normal.
Up, yeah, whatever, within as anyone else. So, yes, this wasn't the holy grail situation. Not that anything should be, and not that I really had that pinned on it. But, yeah. On that level, it was like, shit. And interestingly, although these guys may have been into stumps, they were also still chasing the blonde, blue-eyed, diddly-diddly, that other thing as well.
The Barbie doll with stumps.
Yeah, Barbie doll with stumps.
Fantastic.
And I'm not saying all of them were, but a significant number were. So I realized I was with the same people that bore me anyway.
Right.
Plus a stump thing.
Yeah.
I love it. And when you do have a look on YouTube and all those, and you look it up, and I was just saying to Kath earlier that I love the comments even more than the little 1 minute, 2 minute movies. And it's, you know, like, great, isn't she gorgeous? Love your stumps. Great stump. All these kind of, and it's unusual language, I guess, that I'm perhaps not used to seeing, which I find really, really interesting.
Well, I found it really weird when, these devotees would write to me and they'd say, how long are your stumps? And I sort of think, I have absolutely no idea.
As in how many centimetres?
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. And no, I couldn't be bothered. measuring to find that. I have no interest in.
But that's clearly important to them.
Yes, yes.
We're speaking with Kath Duncan, who made the movie called My One-Legged Dream Lover. She wrote the audio to that movie and also starred in it. It's a doco on her journey to the US and mixing with people who like stumps.
If I can say, Jesus, that was an awful writing job. I don't, people think it's going to be really good to write voiceover for documentary. It was hell. It took me 6 weeks of full-time work to write what is on screen a bit less than 5 minutes.
Well, and it's your own narrative.
Yeah.
How easy could it be?
Oh, I can't explain it. I'd come back each morning into the edit room and I'd go, guys, I've got it. And so they would roll those sequences and I'd be reading and we'd all be like, no, that still doesn't work. And I'd be like, see you again tomorrow, you know. Wow. And, yeah, no, it was pretty bad actually.
I want to go into the complaint a little bit more because I want to work out why people feel uncomfortable if you mix the words disability and sexuality. Because to me it's nothing. You know, there's no difference in anything sort of stuff. But if you say, I have a fetish for leather, people go, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, like but it, disabled right? people aren't supposed to have a
disabled
sexuality.
Disabled people are non-sexual, and that's what I find offensive personally. But I actually even find the word disabled a bit. I'm starting to kind of feel that doesn't make sense to me at the moment. I know.
Yeah, but you're a lesbian.
But I'm.
We've established that.
I'm more of a freak than anything.
Now you're taking Kath's word.
Yeah, you're going to have to sort of, I think I out-freak you, darling. But, yeah, well, but back to what you were saying, hold on. You were talking, right, smarter minds than mine have contemplated this for quite some time, and particularly those British disability philosophers like Tom Shakespeare and what's his name and the other one. I'm really bad with names. Anyway, those guys. And, you know, historically, when you're associated with a pathologizing and a problematizing of your body, then I think you're going to have associated, you know, sexual identity difficulties within that. I mean, you know, lots of us were institutionalized and sterilized and locked away and knocked about the head and so forth and so on. For many decades, even hundreds of years, who knows? And so I think, you know, to sort of see, just for a start, just putting the sex thing on hold, just to see that people who are different are human and have a right to exist and breathe and have opportunities and friendships and all that is sort of like quite a leap at this stage. I mean, it seems obvious to us, but nevertheless, that's been quite a social leap to even get to that point. And in Australia, I have to say, from 1981, which was the International Year of Disabled People, I noticed out there on the streets attitudes had changed. I got so much less picked on. Well, there were these great, you guys are too young to remember, but there were these great posters with like cripples all over the shop. Well, I mean, this is Sydney, but I'm assuming Melbourne did the same thing because it was like bucket loads of money.
I certainly do recall that time.
And years of the Paralympics. Now, I went to the Paralympics in Sydney because I had a media pass and I was just waiting outside such and such. I hate sport. I was waiting outside whatever building, waiting for something to happen. And, this, you know, tourist came up to me and goes, oh, hello, you know, I can't remember the accent, whatever. You know, can I have your autograph? And I suddenly realize I'm a cripple. I'm staying outside the such and such stadium.
You must be an Olympian.
I go, yeah, yeah. And they go, what team are you with? Oh, I'm with the, and I realize I don't know sport at all. Like,
what,
I couldn't even.
What sport do you play?
I couldn't even think of anything. I think I said soccer. And, right. And that the person said, what position do you play? And I'm like, whatever. But anyway, so I signed this autograph. And then the next few days while I was at the Paralympics, I got dressed up a bit more and I stood outside doing exercise. And the funny thing was I'd be outside such and such stadium. It was really funny. People would come to me and go, what's on at the moment? And I realized I didn't know what was, whatever. Anyway, but I'd just say tennis or, you know,
it was a rare opportunity for you to blend in.
Well, and we were in the majority there, which is tops. The radio program I was supposed to be making sort of fell over, but I had a great time. what I'm trying to say is I think I have seen change in my lifetime in terms of the way that I've got treated. But I think sexuality is like a number of people say, remember Katie Ball? She was a great Melbourne identity and she particularly worked in the idea of disability and sexuality. And she used to say sex is the sort of the final frontier. And that we can't really have equality until we have sexual equality as well. And I don't know if my one-legged dream lover really contributed much to that. But on another level, I think in the making of that, it sort of strengthens this network of thinkers and writers and philosophers, not all of whom are disabled, who are out there, who are working in this area. So it sort of adds to that voice. Yes, I think people still struggle with it. And, I know, you know, sometimes I struggle with it as well, because just because I'm disabled doesn't mean that I'm always PC. I know some other people who are disabled as well. And I still think, wow, fancy them having sex. Wow. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, I crack the most inappropriate jokes.
Kath, I know that, you get pretty pissed off sometimes with the disability group.
Anything, really. No, go on.
the groups and advocates for disability. And tell me why they frustrate you sometimes.
Well, what are you referring to? I'm happy for everyone to keep agitating away. Is there something I've said, oh, I'm pissed off about?
Just, I recall you one day coming back from a meeting saying...
Oh, right. Oh, yes. Well, I think I know what you're talking about. Okay. So in the last 10 years or so, I've got involved a lot more with arts and disabilities, sort of sexuality and disabilities sort of floating around up there. But what I'm
finding... It doesn't
finding,
need to be arts. It could be sport and disability.
she doesn't know much about sport.
No, but we're talking about, I guess, organisational structure around the word disability.
What I think the big problem for me is, I went to a conference earlier this year, not in Melbourne, I'll just make that very clear, somewhere else. And interestingly, it was a conference about disability arts. And as I looked around me at the office bearers within that organisation and then within all their little satellite organisations, honest to God, me and maybe Leslie Hall put it, maybe if we were lucky, 20% of the participants at that conference were disabled. And that you could tell in just the structuring of the thing, the place that it was held at, the way that that particular conference worked, you could tell that we were with the very people who are doing very worthy things.
The do-gooders.
On our behalf. Isn't that lovely? And so, you know, I have this constant battle because I try to be polite because unfortunately these are the people that one has to work through to get funding or get access for other people or network or be friend in order to, you know, to not be isolated within disability arts.
But they would say they're trying to help.
It's patronizing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's quite galling. I mean, let's just put this in another sort of framework in that if that was an Indigenous group, you know, the group for Aboriginal artists, and they were 75%, maybe even 80% employing non-Indigenous people, it would be a scandal.
Yes.
But it would be a huge scandal.
Is that because disability is saying that you don't have a voice that's independent? Perhaps still, there's still a threat of
that. Or is it because the diversity of disability? I mean, there is some people who just walk with a limp, and then there are others that can't feed themselves.
I think it's a thing where I see disability as being a cultural thing. It has cultural impact. The fact that I've always been different has had a cultural impact on me, and I've had a cultural impact on the environment. And I think if you just see disability as an amorphous state that any one of you guys could drift in and out of, well, then you're not going to see the reason for why I might be pissed off that it's you behind the desk with the CEO job and I'm coming with the ching, ching, ching begging bowl to get the money. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I see my position and someone who's not disabled as being two different places. I'm not saying we don't have a cord and I'm not saying we don't have allies. But what I'm finding is that sort of way of looking at it of, you know, I'm an ally of these people. I went to another conference, I think the year before, where I got so irate, again in Sydney, where I got so irate that at the end, because I was flown down there to ask a question. And so, down there, well, I can't remember, I was living at the time, but it doesn't matter. But anyway, I actually said, I look around the room because it was a closed, very posh sort of event at the Opera House. And I said, and I see that all the CEOs for all the artistic disability groups generally are non-disabled. I'm one of only maybe 10 disabled people in the room. Why aren't you guys training people up like us to take your jobs? In 10 years' time, none of you should be here. And why are you here?
What was the answer?
Well, actually, the weird thing was I got applauded. And I thought, what? Okay. Yeah. I'm glad they appreciated that. And maybe that was their little gesture. I don't know.
We're speaking with Kath Duncan, who is a writer, a broadcaster. She's been a radio producer. She's made movies. She's been an actor. She's also a loudmouth freak, in her own words. Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson here with you on Word for Word across the Community Radio Network from Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Now, we're talking to Kath Duncan. You've done so much, but I just love the fact that you identify as queer, loud, proud, bent and honourable. Now, how does it go? We've been talking about sexuality, we've been talking about disability, we've been talking about movie making and fetishes. Let's just add queer into the mix. How does that just, does that add another layer?
Or don't you have enough to deal with, woman?
Get on. I always thought that bit was the good bit.
It is the great bit.
So that bit was like the fun bit.
That's the cellophane.
Yeah, people say that, oh, that's dreadful to be dumb, blind, disadvantaged.
No, I'm not saying it's dreadful.
And I'll say, no, the queer thing is the good thing. You know, the rest is something else. Yeah. How does it fit in? Well, I guess I don't know what I describe myself as at the moment. I've always liked bisexual, even though that's kind of not very, you know, groovy really. But once it was.
It's pansexual
and
now.
I've hung on to it since the 70s. Yeah, pansexual is kind of cute, but it makes me think of more that sort of whole free love thing and la la. And I'm not really into that. I'm the honourable thing is actually about respecting my own and other people's relationship boundaries, because I'm not one of those. I've had heaps of sex with all sorts of different people, but you know, I've never had sex with a married person as such. I mean, a person who's got somebody else.
That you know of?
Unless. Well, I've known just about all the people I've had sex with reasonably well, one way or another. I don't do strangers, really. Sort of, you know, slightly vulnerable women like me tend not to do strangers. But I mean by that physically vulnerable in some way, you know, you've got to be a bit smart. But anyway, so, while I'm open to the idea of, you know, whatever people's, you know, marital or other arrangements are, I really need to know what they are before I'll go there with anyone, because I don't want to tread anyone's toes. I've never wanted to do that.
You say you seek positive, self-disciplined people. You are into people with love and compassion in their hearts respect for themselves. You connect to people who have strong drives to create art and joy, nurture love, protect each other and themselves, and who care for themselves and each other.
Yeah, well, I sort of had a bit of a difficulty in that I had a really nasty relationship breakup in October of last year, and really that is where all that's coming from. It's the sense of, I suddenly realised I was in a very nasty situation with someone who was, we owned a house together, we'd raised kids together, not mine, hers, and she wanted to get involved with somebody who I thought was suspect. And I said, no. We had a sort of a relationship by negotiation, would be the best I could call it, in that we would have outside people occasionally, but the other would know who went and how these outside people were and feel okay about that. But we had this huge disagreement about this particular person, and I was invited to go to Britain for a month. And I said, okay, so we either break up before I go, because I will not handle this person in our relationship. This person had a messy relationship and a child themselves, and it was a total mess. And I said to her, we either break up before I go, or when I come back, we work this out. But while I'm away, no, I don't want you to go there. And we were about to refinance our house. Complicate, long story. And I said, I will not come back and throw myself into more debt with you if you've involved this scrag in our relationship and our family and our home and our community while I'm away. Well, she lied to me while I was away. I came back and found out she did. So I walked away. I said, right, that's it. I'm out of here. We'll sell the house. I'm leaving. I'm going to Melbourne. Yay. And so that's what I did. And so those sort of statements about these are the sort of people I look for really much came out of a broken heart.
But this is core value stuff to
yes,
me.
Yes.
It's warts and all.
Yeah. You know?
And these are the things you don't compromise on, is what I get from this.
Oh, well, I try not to. No. Yes, that's right. And I'm very, you know, I don't give a damn what anyone thinks about me. I'm really fussy about who I spend time with.
And you say you're having a bloody good time learning more about yourself, coming into your own space.
Yeah, doing my artwork and writing and doing a bit of work around town.
That's what I want to know. What are you actually working on now? Because you are doing an arts, is it paintings, drawings?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I actually came down here was to work on the Art of Difference Festival, which is going to be held towards the end of next year. in Melbourne, and that's ostensibly what I came down to do. But I'm kind of wrapping up a stage of that at the moment, and I'm going on to do other stuff. What I'm doing at the moment is, yeah, my own work. We sold my house. I'm pretty cashed up. I don't have to make decisions fast. So I'm just sort of enjoying myself and learning my scooter and living with the world's greatest gay guys and two fluffy dogs and getting to know Melbourne. Getting to know Melbourne, yeah. So, you know, what I'd really like to do is to do some more production work, either in, you know, radio, television or print, online, multimedia stuff. Carry on doing the sort of thing I do, just to be kind of a traveling freak. I go to arts and disability stuff all over the place and
I love it.
Our guest today on Word for Word has been Kath Duncan.
Woohoo!
And continued success, Marty. Thank you, Dan. You're a force to be reckoned with.
Oh, indeed you do. Thanks to you too, Sue.
Thanks, Kath. It's been lovely meeting you.
Cheers.
I love the fact you cashed up. I'll be talking to you later.
Thank you for being with us today on Word for Word. I'm Dean Beck.
And I'm Sue Wilkinson.
Now, a podcast of today's interviews will be available to download from joy.org.au. Follow us on Facebook. We welcome your comments and suggestions. If you'd like to contact us, please email us on wordforword@joy.org.au.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Briley and presented by Dean Beck, Sue Wilkinson and Tim Newton.
Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation and is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network, from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.